cannot describe the pain that my family has went through. You know, they didn't just kill my son, they killed part of me. They killed a part of my wife, our daughter. I'm so frustrated because it seems like they have so much rights. We have no rights. What about our son's rights? Where in the hell was his rights out on that ditch bank? He had no rights.
Well, him and a couple little boys were just beautiful little boys, a-playing. Those little boys still believe in Santa Claus. They were beaten to death. I saw my grandson at the funeral home before he was taken out of a body bag, just like he came back from the corner. And it was pitiful.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's long-running show, Criminal Minds, which has led me to have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. And two of my favorite minds are those of my co-hosts, Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, who is my colleague as a writer and producer on Criminal Minds, and also Laura Richards, former New Scotland Yard analyst, advocate, all-around badass superwoman. Today's episode continues the conversation I had with Laura about the murders of 3 8-year-old boys in West Memphis, Arkansas, Christopher Byers, Stephen Branch, and Michael Moore, and the 3 teenagers who were accused and convicted of killing them. When we left off, Laura, who was on Skype from London, and I had been discussing one of the teens, Jesse Miskelly's first confession to law enforcement. Today, we are going to jump right back in and discuss his other quote-unquote confessions. We'll also talk about the occult in America, Led Zeppelin, Ouija boards, and something else that might just surprise you about Laura. You'll have to listen and find out what that is. I do want to warn you that there'll be some graphic descriptions of the crime scene in this episode, but I think I keep my own profanity to a minimum this time.
We know that in particular, it's not something that happens in the UK anymore, as far as I'm aware, but the US system is quite different, where police tactics police in an interrogation are allowed to use deception and disinformation to pressure a suspect. And they can basically say that there's evidence and forensics, for example, that put somebody at a scene, or they could say a polygraph result says one thing rather than another, or they can say things like, you're going to be convicted anyway without a confession, but if you confess, your sentence will be much more lenient.
Right.
And, you know, some are told that a confession is the only way to avoid the death penalty. And so these tactics can be used, and they are incredibly persuasive. And if you are a lone individual in that situation with authority figures bearing down on you, and of course we don't know what happened 45 minutes prior, but if, you know, you're, we understand children in the fact that they're easy to manipulate, you know, we know that those with mental disabilities or low IQ, they're tempted to accommodate and agree with authority figures. And of course, then you can add in the length of an interrogation. And we did talk about Amanda Knox, you know.
Reading my mind. I was just going to say that, yeah.
Because these things are borne out, you know, of cases that we've looked at. If someone is, you know, interrogated by, in that case, they had a number of detectives come in from Rome through the night, and they're using exhaustion as a tactic. And so, you know, some will say whatever it is that they need to say to get themselves out of a situation, thinking that because they're innocent, that will be proven later.
Right.
And, you know, that's one of the key things. If you're innocent and you're genuinely not there, and you know that physically you are not there, it would be very bewildering to find yourself in that situation and people saying that there's physical evidence that you're there. And some who do have a low IQ, you know, who are under pressure and vulnerable, may think it will all get sorted out in the wash at a later date. And they just want that pressure to end.
Yeah.
And therefore they say whatever's required to get themselves out of that immediate stress situation, thinking it will all be worked out later on. And they think that they then go back to their everyday, you know, whatever it is that they're doing, like Brendan Dassey's thinking he's going to go back to class, or he's going to go home and, you know, watch whatever it was on the TV.
Right.
That tells you that somebody's vulnerable because they're not understanding the full situation. And he should have had, now they would have an advocate, because they would be deemed to be vulnerable. And that could be a lawyer or somebody else who's specially trained, because we know that those individuals need extra help and to be advocated for in a system that's terrifying. It's one thing if it's not in your own country, but it's another thing if you've had no real interaction with the police. Yeah. And then you've got these very authoritative police officers bearing down on you and saying these things. You know, and there are lots of reasons and lots of tactics that can be used.
Just to let listeners know, and if you don't know, how Jesse Mascali even came to be in that interrogation room where the police had picked him up that morning. They suspected that he was part of a satanic cult that Damien Eccles, another suspect, was involved in. So they were bringing him in to question him about Damien. And so the first two statements written by the police, which were Detectives Allen and Ridge, they have their pre-polygraph notes. And in these notes, Jesse is claiming he was not involved and that he had heard that Damien Eccles and some other guy named Robert Birch had done the murders. He's being questioned, and then he's given a polygraph test. And after the polygraph test, and this is in the detective's own notes, he's told that he's lying his ass off. And he's told that he's lying about being there. He's lying about this and that. And he's pressured that if he doesn't start telling the truth, he's going to get the needle. He's going to get the chair. And then they show him the picture of the dead child. And he breaks down crying, as people do. And they just push him until they get what they want out of him. At least that's how I read it as a non-professional. I don't know if you agree with that, Laura.
Well, certainly the tactics that are used are, you know, it's not just pressure, it's a real strong arm. You know, saying that you're going to get the needle, putting the most serious consequence on the table would probably make most people say one thing, you know, particularly if they're young, as I've just described about Jesse, who's 17 years of age. I mean, he is a child himself, and we cannot forget that. And if you don't have much interaction with the police, you know, and I have to say, you know, at the moment, I've been looking at a number of cases that have happened over here of young girls who have gone to the police because they're being stalked. And I think I've mentioned them before, Alice Ruggles, who was stalked and murdered up in Northumbria, and Shana Grice, who was stalked and murdered in Sussex. And when they are advocating for themselves, they're saying what's happening to them. And they're being polite, and the police are being very robust with them, and in fact, not believing that they truly are at risk, and the victims are acquiescing. And that's what happens, you know, as a baseline with most people. And that's why you need advocates when you're being, even as a victim, when you're being traumatized and you're in a chaotic situation, you need an advocate. And that's what Paladin does, is the voice for those who are voiceless, and make sure that people do the right things to protect victims. But the same can be said if you're on the other end, if you're in a situation where you've gone in, as he did, to help and to talk about, you know, who was seen where, and you believe that you genuinely are helping. He had no expectation that he was going in as a suspect, from what I am led to believe from the accounts. And next it turns into something very different. And therefore, it's a dynamically unfolding situation. And, you know, of course, when we understand the context, as I mentioned before, that, you know, the community want to see a result. They want to know, they want answers to who did this. And there's tremendous pressure brought to bear on the police. And perhaps they understand that they need to pressure people because they need to get to the bottom of what went on. But those tactics have no place with a young child. It doesn't get you the results that you need. In fact, what we see is other victims that may happen as a consequence. And we did talk about Brendan Dassey. And, you know, in this case, we know that Jesse's confession was the thing that weighed very heavily, because they wanted to effectively get one of them who would then they could use against the others. And, you know, his confession became really the standing thing that they wanted to use in the trial of Damien Eccles and Jason Baldwin. And, you know, they said as much, but they could only get to use that testimony if he agreed, which of course he didn't agree to. However, people do talk about, well, what about the other confessions that Jesse Mascali made, you know, across time? And I think, I don't know if you want to describe any of those, Lisa, for our...
Yeah.
I wanted to start with the first one, but perhaps contextualize the other confessions.
Sure. And just to let, you know, listeners know that some of the other things in that confession that he gets wrong and in some of the other confessions, just to have a little bullet point, sometimes he says that he saw, they took the boys while they were waiting for the school bus, which did not happen because the boys went to school that day. And they don't take a school bus because they live very close to the school. Sometimes he says, you know, the victim skipped school that day. Sometimes he says that both Damien and Jason raped the boys, and then both Damien and Jason raped one boy. And then at one time he says, no, Damien didn't rape him. He was thinking about raping him, but he actually masturbated, ejaculated onto the boy's jeans, and wiped himself with the jeans. I mean, the story so vastly changes. Sometimes he says, I saw Damien, you know, put his penis into the boy. He couldn't get, I mean, he just says things that are just so random and don't make any sense. They don't track in any kind of narrative. He just sort of answers, you know, whatever he thinks that they want to hear. And if you look at the autopsy, if these boys had been, you know, I don't mean to be flippant about what we're talking about. I know it's going to seem like I'm talking about this very casually, and I apologize because I don't feel like it's casual at all. But, you know, if these boys had been raped the way Jesse describes, you would have seen the evidence. And as it is, the medical examiner could barely acknowledge that maybe something could have been, he couldn't rule out that something had been inserted into an anus, but he certainly did not see any trauma that would come with a live child fighting being raped or anything that Miss Skelly describes as far as the physical assault. He, at one time, he says that one of the boys was choked to death, which we know did not happen. There are just so many discrepancies over and over again throughout them, but anyway, so after this at first confession, a lot of our listeners say, well, then he confessed to his lawyer. Well, again, this word confession, did he confess or did his lawyer, you know, who didn't know him and talk to him about what he had told the police, does he just repeat the answers that he gave to the police? And you can see there is one transcription. There is a recorded interview that Dan Stidham, Jesse's lawyer, has with him. This is after Jesse has confessed, quote unquote, to him, where he's asking him further questions. And you can see Dan is not understanding the answers, that they're not making any sense. And yet he's like, okay, well, we're going to plead guilty, but are you sure that you know, you can see that he just doesn't, he's starting to not buy the story that he's being told. So, you want to take on from there, Laura, or, you know, and why would Jesse do that to his own lawyer? Does he not understand that the lawyer is on his side and wants to help him not go to prison, or what do you think?
Well, I think firstly, just to go back to, you know, any physical evidence or evidence around sexual abuse or sexual trauma, one thing to say with young children, we don't always see that physical evidence just because normally, you know, it can be through a groomed process. So you don't see, you know, them being restrained, etc. It's not always clear. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we said we couldn't rule it out, but the pathologist or the medical examiner, as you said, didn't believe that the boys had been raped. And although the prosecutor was trying to get him to say that that had happened, he still made it clear that he could not say that that had happened. And I think it's more important, sort of all the other aspects that Jesse says over time, just the way that he describes things happening, the time sequence is wrong, the place is wrong, you know, where the boys were last seen is wrong. Things that are changed through suggestibility, but then it depends on who's asking him the question, what the context of is of him repeating stuff back. Does he believe it's going to be beneficial to him? There's lots of things that are in the equation there. But certainly the fact he was threatened with the needle, that's not in doubt. And I think that that would be a coercive tactic on its own, and there's certainly clear evidence of suggestibility if we just take facts on their own. For this confession, in inverted commas, what was used or what they wanted to use, that couldn't stand up on its own. And experts could easily, as we did here in Paradise Lost, experts can easily take that apart and show that what he said was coerced and that he does have a low IQ, that he was vulnerable. And actually, that wouldn't stand up in a court of law over here, full stop. So the fact that it's still being questioned and queried, you know, why someone continues to do or say things, we're now in a completely abnormal situation of him trusting the system and expecting the right outcome to happen. Where does a young child, he's 17 years of age, where does he go with that? And I think the true reflection for me was looking at him when the judge asked him at the end, when he was found guilty, was he satisfied with his defence? And again, he just acquiesces to the authority. And, you know, what defence? There was no real defence put. But he didn't challenge that. There were no outbursts. In fact, as all you saw was him doing exactly what he was told, which was to keep your head down. No doubt words from his father and other people. And he did exactly what he was told.
Yeah.
And then you have the issues of the alibis, you know, that other people did see him at a wrestling competition that evening, that he's not even in the right place at the right time, and there's no physical evidence that places him at the scene, and all the inaccuracies that, and we would expect his account to be accurate, the very first account that he gives to be an accurate one of those little details of shoelaces rather than ropes, and it being very clear if he's telling the truth. The devil's in the detail, as I always say. And the detail here, there's so many inaccuracies that have just been completely ignored. That on it, in and of itself, when set in the whole context, his account does and his statement does not would not hold water present day. Certainly not in a court of law in the UK, with vulnerability issues and everything that we've discussed. And I'm sure that there would, you know, I can't speak for America and all the various states, because obviously we've uncovered some real travesties in terms of, you know, historical cases, but also some present day things that are still going on. So we can never say these things will never happen, because they are happening in all parts of the world, sadly. And what Jim and I, and, you know, working with you, Lisa, on our podcast, try and do is shine a light, you know, in a way that we come with a completely independent perspective, and looking at aspects of it, of whether that's good practice or poor or anything in between, and giving some insight and analysis on it. And that's my insight in terms of, you know, Jessie Miss Kelly. And anyone can have a look at the Innocence Project, just to look at, and you can Google things around false confessions and coerced confessions. Coercion is a very powerful thing. And I talk about coercion, you know, in coercive control situations, when we did the pod with Professor Evan Stark. Sexual coercion, you know, it's always about the bigger fear that's for the victim. And the bigger the fear, I would say a life-threatening situation, or threatening someone with the needle or the chair, or that their family are going to be harmed, or that they're going to be going to prison for the rest of their lives if they don't do something. If they know nothing about the criminal justice system, I would imagine that that's a terrifying situation to be placed in. And of course, everybody outside of it makes judgments about it. The lived-in experience, or when you're a professional and you understand how it works, it's a terrifying concept in many respects, if you're at the wrong end of it, or if you are, you know, a victim trying to get help, and your cries and your screams are falling on deaf ears because people don't understand what's happening. So it's very easy to sit in judgment and be on the sidelines judging these things, but we do try and bring an independent analysis to it, understanding that context of both perspectives and the evidence and the facts.
I tell you what, all these people out here that's got kids or had kids, they will tell you that Jesse's not a killer. He was babysitting all these kids out here. If one of the kids got in trouble with a bigger kid, they'd run to Jesse.
We do know that Jesse's father had been in trouble with the law, and to some extent in some of the recants that he talks about, that's part of why he's afraid of the police, that they may try to get to his daddy again, and that they have something against the Miskellys and they have something against him. He has not had great experience with law enforcement in this town. I want to get to, so after the initial confessions, he goes on to recant and his lawyers, you know, defend him as having a coerced confession. Then after the trial, there is this very odd couple of statements that he makes where after it's all over, he confesses again. And to his lawyers become furious with him, and they believe he's perjuring himself in order that he's been gotten to by the prosecutor and by law enforcement, and he's been promised either a lighter sentence or he's been promised to little things, just to see his girlfriend or to be able to see his family. And he makes what a lot of nons or truthers call the Bible confession, where he puts his hand on the Bible in private with his lawyer, and this is recorded, and he says, "No, I really did do it." But again, this story he tells, it still doesn't make any sense. It still is not a narrative that makes sense. I think in this one, if I'm not mistaken, and I'm sure somebody will point it out, he says that Jason Baldwin cut off one of the boys' penises and throws the penis into the water and throws the knife into the water. Well, to my knowledge, a penis was never recovered. And to my knowledge, that's not actually what had happened to the child. And to my knowledge, a knife containing any of that DNA had not been recovered from the scene. So again, his stories become more and more fantastical and strange and really childlike. The way a child would be recounting a fairy tale or something, making it just looser and looser sounding. I don't know if you agree with that one.
Well, certainly, you know, Jesse, as we saw him previously through the police interrogation, certainly through his exchange with his girlfriend, you know, I thought that was an interesting point when they introduced the girlfriend, where he's talking about having sex with her. And again, it's a very simple interaction and you get an insight to how his mind works. And it's sweet at the end of it, him saying, you know, I love you. And, you know, just the way that he interacts and the fact that he's got a girlfriend, it's highly unlikely that he has anything to do with this particular case, these murders that have happened to these boys. And, you know, his reaction on interview, as I mentioned before, he gives wrong answers. He says things that are inaccurate. He's not probed. Nothing that he says is tested. And he's crying on interrogation, which just shows his vulnerability. And so I would imagine that when you flip it the other way, if he's given an incentive to do something, or he gets a sense that, you know, he really is boxed into a corner, he will still say anything that he needs to get himself out, whether that's on a short term that he can see his girlfriend or see his dad. You know, those things, his context becomes highly relevant. And maybe he will say anything possible if it means on the shorter term it will get an end to a situation or get him to see, you know, his family, who clearly we see a lot of footage about him and his family and how close they are. He seems like a normal kid, but low IQ and vulnerable, and therefore he is an easier target to be manipulated and to be put into a position by those who are in authority and those who are in power. So it's my belief in the situation with Jesse. You know, we know that the physical things that you have just described, a penis was not cut off. Some of the injuries that he describes did not happen.
One thing I wanted to mention, so Laura, you mentioned his alibis. Now, I think the alibis in all of these, unfortunately for them, the alibis for all of these teens were just very shaky. And even though I have not read the actual testimony in the trial, but I have seen it reported that the people who went with Jesse to the wrestling match kind of didn't hold up very well on the stand, even though they claim they were all with him. He claims he was with them. Even in his own timeline, he doesn't, in his confessions, quote unquote, it doesn't make sense in the timeline, because he acknowledges that he was at his trailer park with friends and there was an altercation and the police came, and there is there is a report. The police did come to the trailer park to break up some kind of fight. And Jesse was there. And this is around 6:30. Now, this is around the time when the boys are gone missing. And then he puts himself getting a ride to the wrestling match at 7:30. So, and this is a kid who doesn't have a car. So in this time between 6:30 and 7:30, somehow he's walked to the woods, done this crime, walked back, and been taken to a wrestling match. And, you know, so the timeline to me doesn't make sense. I guess I'm sure there are listeners out there who could, you know, pinpoint it for me and prove how it could make sense. But nothing to me is consistent in any of this. So he may be a horrible person. He may be a violent kid. He may be all these things. But to me, this evidence does not prove to me that he was part of this crime. Now, I could be wrong, and I'm happy to, you know, consider all kinds of things. But if this confession doesn't hold up, if his story doesn't hold up, then there's nothing that points to Eccles and Baldwin.
Well, the challenge, you know, there's a clear challenge when you look at cases and you try and understand the crime scene, you're really trying to understand the motive. What is the motive for Jesse Miss Kelly in this? Well, the prosecution were trying to say it's satanic and it's the occult. Well, was there any history of that in Jesse's background? You know, was he known by other people for that sort of behaviour? And was there any evidence of paraphernalia and things at the crime scene? If that's his motivation and the things that he said happened across his, you know, numerous accounts. And of course, there's still no physical evidence of that. There's nothing that places him at the scene. The timeline, it sounds like, you know, he was doing something else and was elsewhere when the boys were last sighted between 5:30 and 6:30, I believe it was. They didn't come back for tea, but people do place him. And, you know, none of these individuals have cast what I would call a cast iron alibi. None of the boys do. And certainly there are a number of the parents and others who were never interviewed robustly to understand what their movements were and their sequence of events. So unfortunately you do have, you know, I won't say any different. There are gaping gaps around people's movements that to me talks about the police investigation. You know, that when these boys are reported missing, the next steps were vital across the hours that evening and the next day. And of course, none of those steps were taken to find out who was where and what was happening. So we've got a number of individuals that are not alibied. But I still go back to, well, what's the motive for Jesse Miss Kelly in particular? He's got a girlfriend. He's been led across this confession to changing his times, to complete somebody else's account becoming his, putting words into his mouth. And so nothing here is reliable. And so his alibi, yes, you know, I do believe that he was doing other things that evening that probably were not particularly significant to him at the time. And a lot of people are called into the courtroom who, you know, at best are dubious in terms of the accounts that they give. And I think some of it, you know, we're seeing small town and we're seeing pressure put on individuals. So, you know, eyewitness testimony, as we know, is unreliable, full stop, unless something very significant happens at that point. When someone's seeing something or something's happening, it's incredibly unreliable. And unfortunately, Jesse's probably, you know, part of that, in that people placing him and who are questioned, it's not 100%. But I do believe there are a number of people, and what would they all gain by saying that he was in one place rather than another? And as you say, police accounts place him somewhere, then it seems like he would have a very busy and hectic evening, because the timescales don't match for what was done at this particular crime scene.
I'm getting nervous every day.
Why?
Why?
Oh.
Why?
Okay.
That's a stupid question.
Okay.
Well, I can barely hold this phone.
I know.
I don't want to even think about it. I can imagine what they're going to do to me.
And I'm going to get into this with Jim, Laura. I'm just going to ask you briefly, you mentioned, you know, had he ever been a part of satanic rituals and all that stuff. So to me, These satanic rituals look to me like a bunch of kids getting together in the woods, passing a thing of Jack Daniels and a 40 and partying and howling at the moon. I mean, I don't know how satanic these rituals were or if that means anything, if that makes you into this kind of a murderer. I don't know. I'm going to talk about it with Jim because there is a phenomenon, certainly in the American culture, of sort of a wave of middle schoolers and high schoolers becoming very interested in the occult. And certainly it's a trait, you know, throughout humankind. Humans have been interested in the occult. And, you know, I'm going to talk about that with Jim. But I don't know. Do you have that sort of same thing when you were growing up? Did you have people who listened to, you know, Led Zeppelin backwards and Black Sabbath and The Cure and all that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I listened to The Cure, believe it or not, and, you know, went through what, you know, would be described as a goth stage.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God, and I have to see pictures of this. Please send me pictures.
It's quite something. But, you know, and I think lots of teenagers do. And, you know, people get involved with playing with Ouija boards.
Yes,
and, you
yes,
know,
exactly.
All
sorts of things. Yes, exactly.
But that doesn't necessarily make you, because you're exploratory at that age, that absolutely does not make you a killer. And, you know, I do think that there is something about, we talked about the film The Lost Boys, which had a big impact on me growing up and, you know, reached kind of cult status, you know, versus something that's satanic and ritualistic in terms of a crime and a murder and what you would expect to see at that scene if there truly were aspects to do with the occult. And of course, we don't see it in this case. It's absolutely absent. So whether these boys were in the woods, you know, drinking Jack Daniels and, you know, doing Ouija boards or whatever it might be, what is the translation or what's the read across to what happened to these boys? When you see at the crime scene and the behaviours of what happened to those boys, it's absent. So it's completely incongruent. But people are trying to make sense. And I still believe the context is absolutely important, that reading across to the Jamie Bulger case and certain cases that had national and international headlines of kids killing kids, that people think they're looking for one thing where in fact they're looking for something else, and they're ignoring all the things that tell them it's not that thing. People become very myopic.
Yeah.
And you may have kids and people who stand out in a community, you know, their face doesn't fit. And of course, there's a lot of people who talk about that. And I'm not saying that in any respect that these three boys were angels in terms of, you know, Damien Eccles and Jason Baldwin and Jesse Miskelly. I think that is, you know, far from the truth. In many senses, there were difficulties and challenges with each of them. But in terms of how this crime was, what people tried to understand of it, making two and two equal five, and in terms of the evidence that was put at Jesse Miskelly's trial, I think it was very thin. There was no physical evidence placing him there, and that's the challenge with him in particular.
Yeah.
A cult, you know, there was just no physical evidence of that. Yeah. There were no Bibles, there were no signs, there were no candles or bindings, restraints. The restraints that were used were shoelaces. They came from the boys and from somebody else. Yeah. People did not go to those woods, or the perpetrator or perpetrators, with murder in mind. And the only thing I can keep repeating is that we're talking about two very different things. You know, if it's the occult and it's satanic and it's ritualistic, it's normally a planned event. It's planned and it's targeted. People go with those things, that paraphernalia, they have a plan in mind and then they're going to execute it. It's not just happenstance. They come across somebody, you know, in the woods or wherever it might be, and they just happen to have all those things on them, you know, and those cases are few and far between. They're very rare.
Don't they want to leave the victims out to show? I mean, isn't that part of the ritual but leave the sacrifice out, not conceal the crime? Would you agree with that, or?
Well, they may, you know, leave them on display, but it might be in an area that's more remote, for example. But yes, there's a whole ritualistic element to it. And, it, you know, whether it's a sacrifice or whatever is that primary motivation. But these boys were submerged. They were restrained. Clothing was hidden. Someone was trying to conceal what had happened. They were trying to create time and distance between them and it. Mm-hmm. They did not leave paraphernalia out, even suggesting that that was the crime. Yeah. And ergo, it's incongruent. It's a hypothesis, but when you test it as a theory and you look at the crime scene pictures and you understand what was left at the scene, you know, you're talking about apples and pears. You're not talking about the same thing. So whether those boys were, you know, did meet in the woods or did meet in the village and did drink Jack Daniels and wore black and were goths, or, you know, that may well be the case. They may well have done that. But its relevance to this crime, it's zero. It's not relevant because that's not the type of crime that's being committed here.
Well, in wrapping up, one thing I do know with 100% certainty is that this crime scene represented pure evil to the police officers who came across it, to the town, to everyone. It just personified the worst that humankind has to offer. And I think it scared them. It scared everyone from, you know, no matter how many crime scenes that this town had, these law enforcement officers had seen, I don't think they'd ever seen anything like this. And it scared them. And the story about the boys just ripped through the town. I mean, when people say, you know, Jesse had details that he couldn't possibly have known, well, you know, search and rescue people who were on the scene lived behind him and told the neighbors what was at the crime scene. I mean, this was not a secret. Everybody was talking about it and retelling it and retelling it. So, and of course, and which is understandable, but what was there? Even Mark Byers was quoted as saying things that were wildly inaccurate about how the boys had been found, because the story just took hold and snowballed. So it makes it even harder.
Everybody then gets exposed to the same misinformation and disinformation that's going round. You know, misinformation is when it's like Chinese whispers, but disinformation is when information's being purposely fed to people for a reason. And that becomes, you know, that kind of fiction then becomes fact. And so everybody was exposed to that. And I have no doubt, and for me, this is, you know, these are some of the hardest crimes, as we talked about. They're really terribly sad and tragic, you know. And so when three young boys are found murdered brutally, it's a shock to everybody. It's something horrific in a small community. And what tends to happen is then the perpetrator or perpetrators grow, you know, become this monster. And everyone wants to create distance. It can't possibly be one of us. It has to be someone, you know, that's evil and a monster. And you want to psychologically create as much distance because you want these monsters to stand out. And therefore, all these other details are embellished. And I believe that's what went on here, that there was misinformation and disinformation about what happened to those boys. And as shocking and as heinous a crime as it is, that had a very serious play out in terms of who they thought they were looking for. And they were looking for the misfits, people who they felt didn't fit within their community. And they were under pressure. And, you know, we haven't got to Damien Eccles yet and Jason Baldwin, but isolating, and they are three individuals, and we have to talk about them as three individuals and other possible suspects, because I also want to talk about other possible, you know, from the profile that I drew up based on the crime scene behaviours, you know, there are key characteristics I would expect this individual to have. And I would expect them, or if there were more than one, to be an authority figure and to have a history of abuse and violence. Yeah. And a history of abuse and violence is very different from going into the woods and drinking Jack Daniels or, you know, doing Ouija boards. I would expect this person to be quick to anger, quick to rage, and would not want their authority challenged. And it would be explosive, and they would think on their feet, and they would have a degree of not, you know, it's more a modicum of criminal sophistication, as in they would need to create some time and distance, because I do believe they were known to the boys. Mm. Now, this crime scene, if it were these three individuals, and if it were someone like Jesse, you can see that he is not, you know, he's got an IQ of 72. He wouldn't have the capacity, I believe, to carry out all those things and to do those things in the way that he didn't describe, funnily enough, that he doesn't describe doing. He describes all these other things, but he doesn't describe those key things. And I would doubt he would have the capacity, and he would have to be told to do those things. And what I saw of him, and I will say that it's a limited measure and it's lots of information that I've read, but I did see his behavioural baseline, I believe, that was helpful, that the capacity isn't there, but coercion was present. And that's the biggest problem when talking about Jesse Miss Kelly in particular.
Well, we're going to have to pause here. After this conversation with Laura, I ran back to the Criminal Minds office, tackled Jim outside the writer's room, and sat him down to record his thoughts on the case. We get his take on Miss Kelly's confession, and also his opinion on reports that Damien Eccles himself had confessed a bunch of times in front of other witnesses. So stay tuned, and thanks for listening to Real Crime Profile.
So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.